Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Hi, welcome to Linux Link Radio. We're going to be talking today about device drivers. And so we have a nice episode planned out here. I'm Gene Sally, and I'm here with Maciej.
Hi. So this episode is going to be actually, to some extent, a continuation of the topics that we covered, not during the last podcast, but two podcast episodes prior to the last one, where we talked primarily about what you would need to do to port the Linux kernel to a custom device. Adding a new device driver is kind of next step, right? Because when you're done porting all the stuff that you had from a reference platform to your custom hardware, there might be a need for a new device driver.
Sure. Yeah, that's typical. Those tasks sort of go hand in hand, you know, especially folks that are working on really custom equipment. That's usually the next thing they dig into after they get the kernel up and running for whatever basic equipment happens to be on the board.
Yeah, there are actually a couple of solutions out there that allow you to control the hardware design also at the hardware level. I know that some of the FPGAs allow you to control the what devices you include in the hardware. So as you go through an approach like that, writing or adding a new device driver might be a must.
Oh, that's a really good point. I know we have a greater number of people that are interested in using those I don't like to use acronyms, you know, field programmable gate arrays. They're popular among the kids these days.
Good memory.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even have to write that down. Usually I make a cheat sheet of the acronym so I don't sound too clueless. Well, I know like Vertex, we have the Vertex 4. And I think that's what we're fiddling with. I know when we prepared for this.
Yeah, we played with some of the device drivers on Vertex 4 FX platform. Yep.
Yeah, so that's what we use like for our point of reference. It just got the tool. Because I know I think the way that's programmed, it was for a 405 is how it was set up.
Yes.
The one that we, because I know that you set your own up with the tool, but I'm the laziest man on Facebook. I just went and grabbed our stuff and installed. Yeah. I think you did it the real man way.
Yeah, we have actually the one of the platforms from Xilinx, I think, ML405. And that's what we used for some of the exercises in preparation for this podcast.
Yeah.
And we used, I think, Linux Link for the Vertex 4FX.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I did because everything else requires actual work. But anyway, so...
Yeah, thank you.
So device driver, making device driver. So I'm going to let you do most of the talk because, you know, my experimentation with device drivers is new world because I'm userland guy in this whole thing.
And there is, of course, a connection between a userland and the a device driver because you are putting in place a device driver so that your application can take advantage of it, right? If you have a graphics card or a printer connected on a parallel port, there's a device driver, but there's, of course, an application that operates that from a user standpoint, right? So what we'll do is we'll cover both sides, hopefully, time permitting, of course. So what is a device driver?
Oh, that wasn't a rhetorical question. So,
let's explore.
So it's a bit of code, right, that is typically linked into the kernel you can link it into the kernel at runtime or at... at compile time to the kernel that's associated with a certain device.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And whenever you perform, so it's associated with a device which represents itself typically as a file in the file system.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever you open up this file in the file system, you can begin doing things like requesting a read or requesting a write to this particular system. And the kernel goes through and does kernel magic, which I know you'll talk about. For me, it's all kernel magic and does kernel magic and then invokes a function inside of your driver code that actually does whatever work is necessary.
Yeah.
And if you have something if someone does a read, they'll send you a request. You'll get a function will be called. And I know we'll go into more detail about that, but you get a function will be called and say, hey, someone's requesting a read of you.
So let's take as an example a parallel port perhaps. And with parallel port, you can control different devices with parallel port because you really control different signals, right? And device driver allows you to really raise and lower electrical signals on a parallel port. The first, there's actually a structure or, if you will, an interface to each device driver. You have to define a number of different functions in your device driver when you begin. And that framework allows you to...
Well, I'm sorry, I'm kicking everything. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, be careful.
It wasn't excitement or anything. I'm trying
to
shift around.
You just wanted to quiet me down.
Well, they spent like $4 on our table here. So if you even like touch it or whatever else, it's terrible.
That's not that bad.
Oh, $6 or whatever.
Okay, let's go back to our topic.
Goodwill. Anyway.
So when you write a device driver, you have to first identify type of a device driver that you want to write, right? And there are different types. Again, there's a block device driver. There's a character device driver. There's, I think, a network type of device driver.
Oh, yeah.
But for the block device driver and character device driver to communicate with those devices, you can use a special file that's associated with that device driver, right? And we've talked just shortly before recording this podcast about the differences between block device driver and character device driver.
Mm. Am I supposed to remember those?
So let's talk about block device driver and the differences. Okay?
The key difference, the key difference between the two is like one is designed for sequential access, right? Mm-hmm. And which is a character driver, and the other is designed for, if you look just between block and character, right? So block has the concept of seeking and moving and working around some offset from the file, and a character device driver is you read a byte, you write a byte. It's sequential in nature,
right?
That's really the big division between the two.
So the block device driver provides a random access to a chunk of memory that's allocated to that device, and you can just copy the data from user land, and the driver can communicate with applications through those files. So with a character device, when I hear a character device name, mm-hmm. The first thing that I think of is, okay, so I'm transmitting one character at a time. And that's not the case, right? Because what happens is, well, you can transmit a whole bunch of characters at a time.
Sure, yeah.
But because of the definition that one is sequential, the other one is random in nature.
Yeah,
I mean, one is character, the other is block.
Those are really the behavioral things. Like the classic character device driver to get your head around just to understand how one works is dev null, right? Mm. Write characters into it and it just says, okay.
Yeah, so.
So that's a really, if you're looking around to understand exactly how they work and a little one for a sample structure, dev null is the fantastic place to start looking simply because the implementation is so simple.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's talk about the framework of a device driver. Okay. That framework has evolved over time. Mm-hmm. The 2.4 Linux kernel had one version of that framework with an introduction of a 2.6 Linux kernel that the framework was updated, but there are several functions that you have to implement to initialize the driver mm-hmm. and to properly clean up after the driver. Because there's one way in which you can work with a device driver, which is a loadable kernel module, which mm-hmm. allows you to dynamically insert a device driver into a running kernel and remove the driver from the running kernel in a very clean fashion, right? So to ensure a proper initialization and proper cleanup of a device driver, there are several functions. There is a function called, I think, module init.
Yeah.
And a separate function called module exit. Mm-hmm. They both take as a parameter, a single parameter, a name of a function that's responsible for doing the actual work.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So you can name your functions any way you like. Mm-hmm. But you have to pass the names of the functions into the module init and module exit.
Technically, right, you're passing a pointer to the function.
Yeah.
Right. It's not Python no more, right? So it's not PHP.
You spend too much time with those languages.
Yeah, they've poisoned me, haven't they? But no, you know what I mean? In the code, though, when you write it, right, you write the code and say you're getting a pointer to a function. And then, from a coding perspective, you just write the function's name, which if not invoked is a pointer to the function, mm-hmm. if I remember my C way back when. The other really thing you got to, really important thing you have to make sure is you populate a data structure, and the data structure contains the pointers to the rest of the functions used by the module. Mm-hmm. You can call these the functions whatever you want. I know a lot of people call them read, write, control, because in this data structure, they're called read, write, and control. So it just makes your life easier. But the same thing, you have a bunch of pointers to functions inside this data structure so that when the kernel, when you've opened a device driver and the kernel wants to perform, not a kernel, but some user has performed a read operation and the kernel does a lookup and says, oh, okay, it's this particular device driver. I go to this function in order to accomplish that. And here's what I need to do in order to make the call happen. Well, that's how that happens.
Yes. So besides that structure, and as you said, that structure is going to define different operations that end users can perform on a file. Mm-hmm. But besides that structure, you have to also initialize the device driver. And in this case, because we're dealing with parallel port, it would be a character device. And for each character device, you have to define a magic major and minor numbers.
Oh, right?
So let's talk about those two numbers.
I did breeze past that for a second.
Yeah, well, it's a way for a Linux kernel to differentiate between device drivers when you do a file operation, right?
Yeah.
So the functions that you've just mentioned, like read, write, open, close on a file, they have to be performed on a specific device, and appropriate device driver has to respond. Otherwise, you're going to think that from within your application you control a parallel port, but on the other hand, something else is going to flip.
Well, I mean, the curious thing, right? So if you go out and do a ls /dev/null, you'll see dev null is the name, whatever, and then it'll have a major or minor number, which I probably should remember, but I can't. I always seem to forget that. And, you know, if you go create, you know, slash, you know, home, whatever your home directory is, foobar baz, and so, you know, do a make node, right? Which, and that creates this device and it creates a file in a file system that in essence points to a device that just is a, it's like a carrier for the major or minor number of a device driver. You can call that device whatever you want. And lo and behold, the code inside of dev null will get invoked because that's the major or minor number that's been assigned to it. So the name is more there for the convenience of the user. And the major or minor numbers are what the operating system uses to identify which code to run.
Right. So in an init function inside a device driver, what you would do is you would build that association into a device driver. You would specify what the major number is, and then you would specify what the file name is associated with that device driver. Mm-hmm. That file name is going to look for that file under /dev subdirectory, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where you said the make node function comes in handy, and there are different ways of populating that subdirectory.
Yeah.
But let's talk about major and minor number still. Major number allows the Linux kernel to identify a specific driver. The minor number allows it's actually passed onto the device driver itself and allows the driver to behave in a somewhat intelligent way. In other words, it can drive the selection of the execution path.
Yeah, it's just a crude versioning system is how I look at it, right? One set of code and you can get different results out of different minor numbers.
So if you
go that route.
Yeah, right. So one binary driver can actually serve multiple chipsets.
Sure.
And each chipset, for example, might require a different initialization. Mm-hmm. And to tell the kernel which initialization path to take, you would create a device node with a specific minor number, right? So that way, the appropriate path inside the device driver would be executed for initialization.
Yeah.
So we have it out of our way. And so we talked about initialization and exiting.
Yeah.
There's also another macro that you should define in your device driver that tells everybody what is the licensing that you apply to your device driver, whether you inherit your design from any open source work or, well, still permitted, but you can keep the device driver implementation to yourself. If you choose to do that, when you define a device driver, there's a function called, what is it called, Gene? Is it?
Oh, I can't remember. You're the expert at this much. I can never keep track of this sort of stuff.
I think it's module license.
Yeah, it is.
And then in parentheses, you can specify whether it's a GPL, a dual license, or some extent proprietary. Mm-hmm. And based on that definition, when you insert that device driver into the Linux kernel, the insertion is going to go clean, or you will see a message that the Linux kernel is tainted. Right?
Yeah.
You remember that message?
Yeah. I'll reserve my comments on that.
Okay, but well, nevertheless, that module license is one of the macros that it's good to have defined. There are different functions at the user level mm-hmm. when the driver is inserted that would tell end user what is the licensing scheme that applies to that particular device driver.
Yeah. Well, and I know the chances of getting your module accepted into the open source community, if it's not GPL, is something close to zero. It's like, you know, any license other than GPL is the same as saying your module is cooties or something.
And yeah.
From that point on, it won't get accepted. And it's even kind of funny, like some, and this, I'm not sure if it's as prevalent these days, but if you have a problem with a kernel oopsing or whatever, it'll come back with the tainted bit set and you won't get any help because it's a proprietary module and on and on and on. So,
well, but on the other hand, if you want to keep some of the code to yourself, you still can.
Definitely your business. It's just, like I said, you have your module of cooties if you do that.
Yeah. Again, to inside an initialization function, what you do is you call a function called register chr dev, character device, and you pass on the major number and the name of a file. That way your device driver has that association in place and you can communicate from within user land. Now, the second step is to define what those different functions that you define in that initial structure for that file will be doing, right? When you write to that file from a user land, what is it that the device driver is supposed to do with the data that shows up in that file?
You know what we sort of skipped over?
Sorry?
You know what we sort of skipped over?
What did we skip over?
It's probably even worth getting three sentences on, and that is in-tree versus out-of-tree source code placement. I know we're going to talk about this, you know, make sure you do the right thing, but you know, the way 2.6 is set up, right, it basically expects to have you do most of your driver work in the Linux tree, so to speak, and doesn't really support that sort of out-of-tree development. Because before you could reasonably, I'm making quotes with my fingers, reasonably create a module that existed sort of outside the Linux tree. And then you could do a build and you could point it where the Linux kernel was and it would get the symbols from there. And nowadays, right, if you're doing device driver development, this is what I've experimented with, right? You can do device driver. The expected model for doing device driver development is, you know, you put your create a directory in the correct system, right? You create your make file with a few extra pointers to it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I agree with you, Gene, on that, because you can still fairly easily, I think, cross compile a device driver outside of a Linux kernel source.
Even on 2.6?
Yeah, even on 2.6. You basically specify the subdirectory of the Linux kernel where you keep your driver.
Yeah.
And you specify where your Linux kernel source tree lives. And
okay, I couldn't get that to work.
It can actually find the right include files, header files and linkages when you build your driver. It has changed, I think, between the 2.4 and 2.6, just like a framework for the device driver, though.
Ah, okay. Because, you know, for all matter, it's you know, we're sort of clipping along saying... But, you know, we sort of just pass by. It's like, well, when it comes time to compile your device driver, you need a make file, right? Defines what the input files are and otherwise fits into the tree.
And it actually takes up a bit more time to integrate a device driver into a Linux kernel tree. I mean, it's a one-time effort.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if you're just trying to see if a specific device driver is going to do what you want, it might not be worth it, you know, spending all that time and trying to integrate a device driver with the Linux kernel tree. Because then you have to, there are several other things that you have to do to integrate that driver properly into that kernel tree.
Okay. Sorry.
No. Because one thing that actually we should talk about is that there are device drivers that you can build as a loadable kernel modules.
Yeah.
There are device drivers that have to be built into the Linux kernel. And again, end users control that process. Mm-hmm. You can specify whether your driver can be built as a outside of the Linux kernel, meaning as a loadable kernel module, or that it has to be always built as part of a main Linux kernel compilation process.
Oh, okay.
But let's go back to our discussion on a parallel port, and we talked about the initialization process, what you have to do from a licensing standpoint. We've mentioned all the functions that you define inside that structure that tells the driver what are the operations permitted on the file.
Okay.
Should we talk about in a bit more detail what each of those functions or at least one of those functions like a read function would do?
Yeah, let's just talk about read because I think once you establish a pattern, right, you know, read becomes just like read except, well, it's the other direction, right?
So what happens when you call read on, let's say, a device file, right, and a device driver?
Okay, so what happens is out in user land, right? Uh-huh. Out in user land, someone says fopen some, you know, /dev/ Maciej's greatest parallel printer driver ever, right? You would call it that? Okay, and so...
All right. Fine. Maciej and Gene's greatest parallel port ever.
It's all yours. It's entirely your printer driver.
I know you don't like parallel ports, but...
No, okay. I don't. It's Anyway, so you open that file handle. So at this point, you have a file descriptor, right? And actually, at this point, Linux is called into that device driver and said, hey, someone's attempting an open. Mm-hmm. Do you need to do anything to attempt this open? Yeah. It also maintains a data structure that says, okay, this for a particular process, there's a great big chain of these. There's always for a process, right? So there's a big chain that says, hey, this person has a file handle opening against this device. And when it did the open, it also got sort of smart and went through and said, okay, here's the major number. And based on the major number, there's a table that says, aha, here's the data structure that contains the offsets, mm-hmm. Where to call, and it keeps a little cache of that. And so then what happens when you go ahead and do your write? So say you write a byte to this thing, right?
Yeah.
So at that point, the system will say, hey, you're writing to a file handle. It'll go from the file handle and it looks across to its cache and says, aha, in this data structure, I need to call this function because it already has the right pointer to the function call, mm-hmm. sets up a call on the stack and at that point takes the pointer to the memory out there in user land and then puts that on the stack. Mm-hmm. It definitely puts the minor number on there too.
Yeah.
And then calls into your function.
Right. And then there's also a system call involved?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's the way you pass the control over to a kernel.
Yes.
And kernel can execute the device driver code. Now, in many cases, well, one fact is you can't simply pass any data from user land to the Linux kernel land other than through those device files.
Yeah, because in there, there's because what you do is inside there, you do a copy from user or copy to user function. Right. Because remember, you guys are operating on, well, not you guys.
Yeah.
These things are operating on two completely different address spaces, right?
Exactly.
So the address space if you get a pointer from a user land address space, it makes positively no sense, right? Because at the kernel, there's no memory management concept. Right. There's the number, because a pointer is just a number that points somewhere in memory.
Yep.
That needs to be translated to the page it happens to be really occupying in physical memory and so on. Right. So there's like a copy from user in this case function. Yeah.
There's copy from user and copy to user, right? And that happens inside the function, inside the device driver that's responsible for handling that
Absolutely. File. Yeah, that's entirely your problem to do the fetch out of user land.
So inside the device driver, let's say under parallel port read or write, you would call...
It's Mate's greatest parallel printer driver ever.
Okay. It's a long name though. Copy to or from user space. Yeah. And when you do that, you can then pass on the data on a wire. Right, because now you are within the Linux kernel space, you have the data that your application passed on, and so you can either control a behavior of a device that you have attached on the parallel port. It mm-hmm. can be also an I/O to some extent, right? Just the raising and lowering a voltage on one of the pins.
Sure.
So you can in a binary fashion control on and off switch through a pallet port this way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you have a character device that's set up, you could be sending in a bit mask, right? And then whatever bit happens to be set, you could turn on a particular, you could raise, I think they call it raise in the great big electronic war, right? You could raise one of the signals on one of the pins, right?
Right. I know a couple guys I know have used the parallel port to control some of the entire all lights in the house, and they were fortunate enough to have all the light switches in one box. They reworked their box and attached it to a parallel port, and they were able to control the behavior remotely, which involves also additional application and user land. But nevertheless, that parallel port could potentially allow you to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that's pretty much what we wanted to cover at the device driver. You're waving your pencil.
One of the things we sort of left out of this whole thing is the fact that, hey, device driver land, there's no libc, right? I know I'm the user land wussy man, whatever, but there's no libc in kernel, right? And that's really the thing you have to watch it. Like, so a lot of the functions you would typically see in C, like printf, right? They've been re-implemented. Mm-hmm. So there's like kprint and there's kmalloc for malloc. And so a lot of the functions aren't the same.
Right.
They're slightly different. It's like Canada functions, right? Everything's just slightly different from the other function, right? So you just stick a K in front of them somewhere.
I think what you're getting at is that with a device driver, it's no different than with the Linux kernel. Once you insert a device driver into a kernel, it becomes an integral part of the Linux kernel and hence can use the same set of definitions and macros that kernel internals are using.
Mm-hmm. And more precisely, can't use anything else other than those.
Yes.
Right? There's no other. I mean, the idea of using a shared library in the kernel is just...
Oh, doesn't exist.
It's like red wine, red wine and fish, for God's sake. So it's really something you got to have your head around. And you know, the other thing, too, that I thought was really... that was fascinating, too, is that there's no memory protection.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have the memory management unit running, you can gladly write all over the place. Yeah. And sometimes your mistakes aren't found until later. And if you're lucky, they're not found until much later. But no, I mean, seriously.
I know. In
my experimentation with sort of stuff, you can do bad things.
Right. For example, disable all interrupts.
Yeah, sure.
That's one of major problems for systems that want to perform in a certain way from a real-time standpoint. In the old days, a lot of bad implementations of device drivers were simply disabling all the all the interrupts in the system just to do one task, right? And when you do that, well, forget about handling the traffic on your TCP/IP connection because it's not going to happen.
Well, that's a good thing you point that out too, because the other thing you need to have your head screwed on right for is endianness issues. Mm. There's a whole set of macros that deal with endianness, but you can't make assumptions about the endianness of the platform you're running on. Endianness is whether it's most significant bits first or last. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know that so you brought that up. It made me think of it for TCP/IP protocol, right? There are functions that say, hey, swap around the endianness of this so that it runs as a proper endian for my platform based upon the standard. I think TCP/IP is little endian, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe. So everything goes over the little endian, but you still there's the equivalent of routines that say, translate this from little endian to my host. And from my host to little endian and big endian back and forth. Yeah. So if you do things that you care about what order your bits are in, you need to be cognizant of that. Otherwise, you'll get some really interesting bugs whenever you try to run your code on a different platform.
One last topic before we end up this episode is different ways in which you can create device nodes. There's, of course, a manual way by simply calling a make node, right? Uh-huh. And that's when a Linux kernel is already up and you want to add manually different files that are missing. So that's where you would use make node. You'd specify whether you want to add a block or character device. You would specify major and minor number for that device, which you can find through proc. However, there are other options. You can build a static device table that you keep in your root file system permanently. You can also use a dynamic approach with UDEF, for example, to populate dynamically the /dev subdirectory.
Yeah, but so, I know a lot of embedded folks, they start out with UDEV because it's the laziest way to get your thing. But for most production systems, people will create them actually in their target, in their file system. Like JFFS2, I know has you can pass in a little file on the side with the device nodes that you wanted to create and it'll make them for you.
Well, the reason is UDEV takes time. And an embedded system, what counts is how fast the Linux kernel can boot up on a card, right? And unless you have all the device nodes present, none of the devices are going to be available to applications. So applications cannot start.
Yeah.
So having a static device nodes absolutely makes sense in a small embedded systems.
Oh, and I guess the other thing I wanted to mention too is that, let's say you're working on your device driver and you want it to be, you're going to license it under GPL and you want it to make sure it gets out there. There's some great coding style information out there. If you go to the documentation directory, look at the coding style file. And there are some very particular instructions as to the right way to format your C file. Because if you add it in for a patch and it doesn't match, you know, coding standards, it's acceptance. And you hate to have something that works that gets
you
caught up.
You have to rewrite at one
point. Yeah, because the tabs are wrong and everything else. You know how that works.
Absolutely.
And I know they're nice enough because they went through there, but they're nice enough to make sure they have a little list script for those people that use the Emacs editor. Mm-hmm. Of course, I think VI does the right thing out of the box, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, if you need to set up VX so that it properly, I'm sorry, if you need to set up Emacs so that it properly edits your file, you know, set put sorry tabs spacing and all that other stuff, they do have a little scriptlet for that.
Again, where you can find all that?
That's in documentation/coding style. Capital S.
It's inside the Linux kernel source tree.
Yeah, it's right in there.
Under documentation coding styles.
Yeah, and it's really cool. I mean, there's a lot of comments in there. You can tell it was written by people that did C, and you know, they suggested, you know, simple things like, hey, don't inline everything. You know,
yeah.
Inlining does not increase performance in all cases, because some people believe that inlining really does. And and while you're at it, you know, don't call it, you know, Mach's greatest printer driver ever. You know,
you
use sane names. And
you answered my question.
Yeah, and you know, and stuff like that. And you know, don't put too many comments in. So a lot of the coding style comments are. I know. I'm getting told to be quiet from the marketing podcast czar guy. That's too bad. But
czar guy.
But I mean, it's still important because you put that effort into. You want to get it accepted, and you hate to have your job be, you know, run set 1,000 times to fix all your problems.
I think that this podcast is very interesting. If there are any other questions that you, our listeners, have around writing, how to write a device driver, or any of the aspects of writing the device driver that we've raised during today's episode, please do let us know. You can email us at podcast@timesys.com. You can visit us at www.timesys.com. And we are getting quite a few emails these days with comments and questions and suggestions. And I would like to use that opportunity and thank you very much for listening to us and for sharing with us all your thoughts.
Yeah, we get some great email in, and we said we do. I know we read all of them, and I know we attempt to reply to all of them in a timely manner, even the hate mail. So. You know, please feel free, questions, comments.
That one goes only to you.
it is usually directed at me, actually. So, but that's okay.
No.
Write in podcast@timesys.com, or you can visit us, I think, linuxlinkradio.com. I think that's all working too.
URL. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.